Ronald, Jesse, Real, Four. We were talking about conditions during the Arctic convoys and a heavy weather.
Yes.
Is there any more?
Yes. It's well known that ice forms on ships when you get above the Arctic Circle, and the impingement of that upon us in the engine room department was that the sides of the mess became coated in ice, and I'm talking 2 inches thick of ice, which was okay whilst it was still ice, but as you came further back south, this all started to melt. And this is condensation ice, and it started to melt and was most unpleasant, or swimming about on the floor. And if you were to be slinging your hammock by the side of that side of the ship, as the ship rolled, your hammock would get all wet. Fortunately, I don't think I ever had a hammock billet in the mess. I was always down in the gangway somewhere, one of the gangways. But the condition in the engine room was quite pleasant. The bright lights, a harmonious atmosphere, by which I mean it was a pleasantly warm draft through the air conditioning system, through the air the fan system, blowing fresh air into the engine rooms. There was two systems. There was an extraction system which took hot, steamy air out, and a supply system which blew air onto the operator's control positions so that everybody who had a job to do could stand beneath a fan blast. And in the Arctic circumstances, there was a steam heating system in the fan, and it was just plainly not unpleasant. It wasn't as warm as in a house, for instance, but it was pleasant enough to stand near. And so we had bright lights, we had overalls without the necessity to be wearing coats. We could smoke, and it was quite pleasant. So, but up on deck, it was anything but. And if you did go up on deck to see the scenery, the sea going by, you had to hold on to something, and the ropes were rigged on the upper deck so that you always had a handhold. And the seas were, except for this one exception that I've mentioned of the sea going to Iceland on our first trip, but always rough, sometimes howling gales, but always choppy and with white horses flying. It would always be coming and splashing over onto the decks. The front of the ship was coated in heavy ice. Once you got above a certain latitude, every time we went up there, and the men would be set, the seamen would be set to chipping it off with scrapers and hammers to try and keep the guns working. And because the front of a gun, although it's heavily armoured, where the barrel goes up and down, is a cloth, a canvas screen, so that if ice forms on that, it can interfere with the operation of the gun barrel. Keep the ice. They had to keep the ice moving, and everybody up on the bridge works doing their lookout duties had balaclava coats and balaclava helmet, duffel coats and balaclava helmets under balaclava hats on underneath their duffel coats, and they looked like men from Mars. But the captain and the other officers were never allowed this to have anything on other than their peaked hat. I was going to mention that whenever we were on duty, we always wore our hat, which designated, even under emergency conditions, who you were and that what you said carried authority. And this applied to captains and officers on the bridge. Signalling, I was always intrigued at the efficiency with which the signallers managed to talk to one another across miles of ocean. They would flash their flash their signal lamps, and instantly everybody on each ship knew what was happening and messages were passed. I suppose there were mistakes, but it always seemed to me it was jolly efficient. And they were up on these exposed positions, and their lanterns had to be kept free of ice so that the shutters would always be on the move very quickly. Nowadays, of course, they use intership radios, but not then.
Do you have any other memories of life during the time that Belfast was on convoy duty?
Yes. A lady poking her head out of a porthole of a Russian oiler. And evidently they had lady seamen on these oilers. And the oiler was alongside us in Murmansk. And we were taking aboard a load of oil, and she poked her head out, and we had quite a non-conversation. She was speaking Russian and we were speaking English. The difficulty of starting boat engines, they were diesel-driven, diesel boats, and the only way we could, in Murmansk Harbour, or indeed in Icelandic harbours, the only way we found we could get these engines to start was by lighting an oily rag at the air intake so that they sucked in literally flames, and that would make it hot enough for the engines to fire and get going. And this is a fairly hairy business, not to be recommended in the case of anybody's motor car. But that certainly worked with the Perkins diesel engines, am I allowed to advertise, which all the boats were fitted with. And it was quite important to get the Admiral's barge going, because he was the first away in Murmansk to see his opposite numbers in the Russian Navy. And it was not good for them to be kept waiting, the Russians to be kept waiting for the English Admiral, who couldn't start his boat engines. So when you were boat ERA, you had quite a job on. And if you were boat ERA, you had to go and shin down the ladders to get to the boats in the water beneath a boom. And that you had to climb down a rope ladder to get to them, carrying your tools and with a duffel coat on. It's not easy. Any other memories? I saw the Ice Edge once when we were sailing quite close to it, and to my surprise, it was blue. And I thought, oh yes, that's the Arctic Circle, and went back down below again because it was cold. I don't think I can remember or contribute much else on Arctic convoys. We never saw a convoy as a cruiser formation. Am I talking about this? As a cruiser formation, we were always kept 50 miles away from the convoy, going backwards and forwards, but not near enough to be hit by submarines, and placing ourselves fairly between the convoy and any likelihood of attacking ship, surface ship attacks. So I never saw a convoy, but it was very comforting to see two other ships, one on either side. We were always in the middle because we were the leading ship. And there's always one on either side, and I always felt very comforted by the fact that there were three of us.
You were on board the Belfast during the time that she was involved in the sinking of the Shamrock.
Yes, I was.
Can you tell me about that? What was the first time you knew that you were going into... when was the first time you knew you were going into action?
The night before. Items of overall interest to what the ship was doing were communicated by the commander, who had his own action stations at the back end of the ship. In case the captain was killed, he would then take over. And one of his jobs was to keep the ship's company informed of what was happening. And the night before, he said that we have information that the Scharnhorst might be coming to sea. Everybody look to their laurels and make sure that everything's as it should be and hunky-dory, and we'll have a crack at her. And I thought that's a state of affairs I'd rather not know about. But he did give us a warning that it might well be coming out that night. And I know now where he got his information from. So we went about our normal routine, and my watch was, my next watch was the forenoon watch. And as I came on watch at 8 o'clock, we had been at action stations for some while, some hour or so before, but they came on watch, and we were told then that the Scharnhorst was picked up on radar. And I remember the commander, the chief, who was in the engine room, same engine room as me, doing his job, which was not only looking after the engine rooms, but also in charge of damage control. And he walked around and said, well, the first thing we must make sure of, Chief ERA, is that we've got enough water. Water. But he meant water for the boilers, make sure that all the tanks for the boilers, because if you take any damage, it's absolutely crucial that you don't lose any more water than you must, because the boilers just won't work with seawater. They must have pure water. And so I thought, well, that's a... And he was cool, calm and collected, and I wasn't a bit worried. I was quite sure that three cruisers would make short work of that blighter. The bang started, and we worked up to full speed, and the bangs went on, and the shudders and the bangs, and then it all died away, and the commander said, she's made off, and sure enough, she'd made off. So we then came to a second degree of readiness, because she'd gone off over the horizon. Came to a second degree of readiness, and we were able to change watches at the end of the shift. Now, for some reason, I must have gone to the toilet or something, because I was on the upper deck and I saw destroyers joining us, you know, all zooming across at high speed, four destroyers coming to join us. I thought, well, that's comforting as well. The more the merrier. And then I came off shift and went on to one of my damage control stations, and there was another action at half past 12 or thereabouts, lots of bangs and booms, and we drove her off again. And
what was the atmosphere on board?
Calm and collected and confident. I don't think people realised the danger we were in, and it is you're full of confidence, because you can hear your own guns going bang every few minutes. And bear in mind, because we could, if need be, get off 100 rounds a minute of 6-inch shells, which is a tremendous outpouring, and anything that was coming our way was missing, and we were just full of confidence. I had moved to my damage control station, and it was down in the steering, near the steering area, and I was able to see the coxswain doing his steering, and to watch the men working their gun control mechanisms, and to watch the gyro compass. There wasn't any need for me to do anything, just to be there. And it was later on that I saw the gyro compass suddenly turn from going south, from going south, that went right round through west to east, 270 degrees. I knew that something sharp had happened, and in fact that was the moment when the Duke of York was setting about the... We'd been following her, and Duke of York was setting about her, and we did this funny wiggle to go on, and on we went till the Scharnhorst was sunk. I shot up on deck when I heard that the commander said, "And she's on fire." I went up on deck, left my action station, I regret to say, along with a lot of other people, to cheer. And there she was burning in the about 10 miles away.
What could you see?
Just a glow. Nothing, it was dark. The whole action was in the, very nearly the whole action was in the dark. And it was because of our use of flashless cordite and the fact that we had a very highly efficient gunnery radar that gave us the edge over the Scharnhorst, who had no such technical superiority. Then she was on fire. Shortly afterwards, she sank, and we were able to go and look to see if there were any survivors. A terrible smell of oil. And then we went to Murmansk without any further ado and spliced the main brace.
Celebrations.
Celebrations, yes. And the next day, or a day or two later, we shot off back to Scapa Flow at high speed and dropped a wreath. I don't think we did any more convoys after that, we went on a Bodo raid and something else, but virtually that was the end of our northern experience. We went into a long refit in Newcastle, and prepared ourselves for the second front.
What to you during that long refit?
I had the most marvellous time. We were in South Shields, in a dock called Smith's Dock, and we had all sorts of extra things fitted for use in the Far East, because we were then assigned for the Far East later. Much more in the way of ventilation and extra guns. And I was able to go up to Newcastle and resume my dancing classes and to get to know one or two girls, which I hadn't had the opportunity to do up to then, and to go to the theatre, because, life went on in Newcastle. And been to theatre before, and to help the dockyards. But I was, there weren't many people in the ship, only a few key people, of whom I was one, and to assist and advise the dockyardsmen on the best way to do what they had to do. There's the best way to run their pipes and the things which we'd found to be weak or faulty in our Arctic experience. And I also did a lot of improvement work myself, which I don't think we want to go into here, do we? Like putting valve spindles up through armoured deck so that we could work the engines from above decks. Instead of there need be nobody in the engine room, we could work all the valves under emergency from above the decks, which meant taking all the valve spindles up through the decks, which meant drilling quite large holes with rudimentary ratchet drills. And that's the sort of work I got up to. I quite enjoyed that experience. And then we went back to Scapa Flow and we practiced like crazy for all the sorts of things that might befall us when we were doing bombardments for the second front.
Was it a new ship's crew?
Yes, it was a new ship's crew. And we had to work up a new ship's crew, especially for that purpose. And this was mainly, we expected to be attacked by submarines, and we expected to be attacked by light craft, like torpedo boats. And so our light guns, our 4-inch guns, were given exhaustive practice in shooting at moving targets. They were primarily for anti-aircraft use, but they could also be depressed for surface firing, and they were trained exhaustively and to repel torpedo boats. And we uprated our gunnery procedures for bombardment use instead of anti-ship use. As regards the engine room, we were not expecting to receive very much in the way of onslaught. Nevertheless, we were strictly all wearing anti-flash gear, and we had exhaustive practice in putting the lights out and working the engines on emergency lighting only. That's with torches and wheel spanners and that sort of thing. In fact, one thing I ought to mention was that when you are on action stations, you had your gas mask, your anti-flash gear, you had a torch, you had a wheel spanner, which is a wrench for turning valve wheels. You had a packet of biscuits if you had any sense. You had a little bottle of rum if you had any sense, and you had a cigarette and a waterproof cigarette lighter. And this you always kept by you, and you always had it with you when you went to action stations.
What did your anti-flash gear consist of?
An asbestos cloth hood, which covered most of your face except eyes, mouth, and nose, and gloves, which covered up to above your elbows, also of asbestos material. And it was solely that if there was an explosion in the vicinity, the flash could do you more harm than the actual physical force of the explosion, and in fact it could take your skin off. And they were very effective. Heaven knows why we were made to carry gas masks around the whole time, with the chances of having to endure a gas attack were vanishingly remote, I should have thought. But nevertheless, we did, and it was quite a convenient thing to put your bottle of rum and your packet of biscuits in, and anything else you fancied to carry. It was always with you.
How long did those exercises last?
Only about a fortnight. We were training the new ship's company for a bit longer than that, but the actual exercises for the second front only lasted about a fortnight, because who was doing what was always had been a closely guarded secret until the last possible minute, and it was only about a fortnight before that Belfast knew of its role and what it was going to do.
And what was the mood on board when the Belfast knew?
High excitement. We set sail from Glasgow in company with some other ships, including the Queen Elizabeth battleship. And the Queen Elizabeth battleship sailed down the Clyde with all flags flying and the band playing and such like. Everybody knew what we were off to do. Nobody knew where or when, but everybody knew what we were off to do. And there was an atmosphere of high excitement. And we could almost see the end of the war just over the horizon. Of course, it was not to be, but nevertheless, that was the atmosphere. And we sailed off under darkened ship, of course, sailed off down the Irish Sea, our squadron. I think we were the flagship of the second cruiser squadron, but we were in company with the Queen Elizabeth and four other cruisers, and we sailed down the Irish Sea, out of sight of land. And when we got to the north coast of Cornwall, the project was put back 24 hours. So we had to waste 24 hours, and we sailed round and round Lundy Island, I remember. And first of all, we went twice round one way and then turned round and went twice round the other way, because we were getting giddy. But we just had to lose time before we picked up the schedule and then sailed along the south coast. And we were able to line the decks. We were at cruising stations, there was no anxiety. Line the decks and wave and cheer to all the soldiers. The soldiers and their landing craft were all waving back and full of cheerfulness. And we were overhauling these dozens of them as we went along the south coast. They were all coming out of their little harbours and taking up their allotted stations. And then that night we turned south off the Isle of Wight and made our way slowly across the English Channel according to the schedule, so as to arrive off the French coast at 6 the next morning.
What was the scene like as you went across the channel?
That was in at night time.
But before then, you said there were other landing craft.
Yes, landing craft. They were in lines of six, and we would overhaul one line of six, and everybody was waving and cheering, and then we would go on a bit further, and there's another line of six, and I suppose we must have passed something like 50 of them going through quite a choppy sea, they were on their decks, and the tanks were down inside. They were tank landing craft mainly. And so we turned south off the Needles and spent the night going down across the channel behind the minesweepers so as to arrive off the beaches at 6 o'clock.
Were there any other, you mentioned minesweepers, were there any other Navy ships around?
We were a group of six, a battleship and five cruisers, and we were going to do our bit, and there were others behind us, but we were the first. A fleet of minesweepers in front to sweep the mines away, and we were homing in on a submarine beacon which was lying half submerged off the shore, giving us a beacon as to what as the point to aim for. We arrived at 6 o'clock, and I had that morning watch, and we were going ever so slowly on cruising engines, which is a cruising turbine clutched in front of the main turbines, which didn't use much fuel, which is economical. But you normally would only use that for long distance cruising, economical cruising. And we eventually arrived at our station and stopped. And the first thing I thought was going to happen was that the chief engineer would instruct us to declutch the cruising engines. "Oh no," he said, "don't do that. Stay where you are. We aren't going anywhere." And I thought we were going to hair up and down at high speed, blasting everything in sight. Quite the opposite. We just stopped. And then it started, bang, 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 bang. And the announcement was made that HMS Belfast fires the first shots in the relief of Europe. And it carried on for the next, couple of hours. Pretty regular and determined and as if every shot that was known where it was going, and you put six in this place and six in that place and six somewhere else. And all we had to do was just keep manoeuvring to keep the ship faced at the correct angle to the shore and stem the tide and keep our position. Somebody on shore was telling us where the fall of shot was.